Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Bitcoin itself is not a good smart contract platform because the choices that Satoshi made are very, very conservative. There was, you know, the block size wars, which basically solidified a certain path forwards, which means that Bitcoin is becoming more and more of a store of value and less of a payment network, which is okay to me if we can build layers on top of Bitcoins.
This episode of The Protocol is sponsored by the Stellar Community Fund.
Dive deep into the blockchain realm with The Protocol podcast. With CoinDesk founding editor of The Protocol newsletter, Brad Cowan, and tech journalists, Sam Kessler and Margot Nykerk. They unravel the intricate technologies powering cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum, one block at a time. Just a reminder, CoinDesk is a news source and does not provide investment advice.
Hello and welcome to The Protocol podcast. I'm Brad Cowan here with my co-hosts, Margot Nykerk and Sam Kessler. We're very excited to dive into today's show with the latest news and developments in technology behind crypto and blockchains. First, please do not forget to subscribe to our weekly newsletter, The Protocol, on Coindesk.com. And let's dive right into it. Today, we have somewhat of an OG, Sergio Damian Lerner, joining us from Buenos Aires. And Sergio, just reading about your fascinating background, and we're going to get into a lot of this. Sergio is the chief scientist at Rootstock, which is obviously one of the leading Bitcoin layer two projects. But Sergio's had a pretty interesting, wide ranging career, also as a researcher, even before Rootstock, and has been around at least since 2013, probably a little bit before that, Sergio?
2012, probably. Yeah.
2012, okay. Well, just to get folks warmed up, they may know you from Rootstock or they may know Rootstock, but one of the most interesting things in your career is the research that you did on this Satoshi pattern, right?
Yep.
Which was essentially identifying this unique Bitcoin mining pattern of the coins that Satoshi mined kind of before Bitcoin became popular, and then determining that he had minted a million coins, right?
And so, yep.
But just tell us maybe a little bit, how did you know the brief Cliff Notes version, the 3 minute to 4 minute version, how did you get onto that?
Yeah, so first, thanks everyone for having me. Very excited to be here. So the story is that I was working on the security of Bitcoin since 2011, actually, the end of 2011, reporting vulnerabilities and trying to harden the code to make it more secure. But I didn't own Bitcoin. Actually, I worked for more than 2 years trying to improve Bitcoin without having any Bitcoin, without having mined any Bitcoin or bought any Bitcoin. It was very hard to access Bitcoin from Argentina. So at certain point in time in 2013, I say, okay, this is the time. I have to have some skin in the game. I'm going to buy a little bit of it. And so before that, you know, people, I come from cybersecurity, and people from cybersecurity, they are completely paranoid, right? They did try to understand everything before, you know, taking a decision, right? So I wanted to know what happened with the early Bitcoins, because I wanted to know if they were all, you know, owned by some certain person, or they were equally distributed, or what had happened. So I was discussing this in Bitcoin Talk forums, and I made a very, very simple computation. I said, if Satoshi was running a computer in the very early days of Bitcoin, and that computer just ran alone, let's say for a few hours, until everyone joined the network, whatever. And if he continued running that computer for a whole year, he would have 1 million Bitcoins. And it was as simple as that, just assuming that the computer that Satoshi turned on in 2009 was on the whole year. So for me, it was very easy assumption to make. But you know, those times in Bitcoin forums, there was a lot of, you know, harsh environment sometimes and a lot of criticism. And I got, you know, people very angry at me because I was kind of demystifying, you know, the figure of Satoshi. So I left the forum. I went to my computer and said, what evidence I can get about this? And so I found that there was a leak of information in the all the early blocks during the whole first year and a half, where certain information about the speed of the computer was being leaked in every single block that was mined. And so I could identify exactly which computers had the same exact speed of mining. And there are no two computers with the same, you know, speed, right? So I was able to link all these Coinbases and one to the other until I get a picture, you know, in a graph where it was super clear that there was just one computer. I call this the Patoshi pattern, that was just one computer that had mined, you know, about 1.1 million Bitcoins. But I think that was not the most interesting discovery. I think that the most shocking discovery was that Satoshi had not ever spent, no, he had played with Bitcoins in the early month, like giving for free, but he had never spent those Bitcoins along all those years, which made Satoshi, you know, a people of, you know, enormous trust on the system, right? So that's two things I published in a blog post. I think it was like 2 a.m. in the morning. I was very excited. I published it and I just stared at the numbers, at the statistic. And I saw that my blog post had, you know, 10 visits a day. That was top. And then I started looking at the numbers, and it was like 100, 1,000. 2,000, 3,000, and I got 35,000 visits in just a day and a half, which means that everyone in the community at that point in time, I probably that was everyone, had read my article. And then there was a lot of discussions, and then the thing became a known fact. Like after many years, it became like a research that everybody now trusts, and many other people have verified under several different methods. Like I found 5 different ways of identifying Satoshi blocks. So for me, it was I convinced myself that this was fair. Even if I found a kind of a whale, I convinced myself that it was safe. So I started, I actually didn't buy any Bitcoin ever. I just started working and have my salary be paid in Bitcoin.
Fascinating. Thank you, Sergio. What an incredible story. And it's also convenient that it's just a nice, clean 1 million. It makes the calculation so easy. I was just looking at the Bitcoin price here, which I won't ask you about the Bitcoin price, but it is about $69,000. So we're talking about $69 billion worth of Bitcoin, and it's just kind of sitting there, presumed dead, right?
Yeah.
We don't know for sure. But that is fascinating. Okay, well, we brought Sergio on for a number of reasons for this show. And they are, number one, we've got the halving coming up. And so we wanted somebody who really has been around Bitcoin a long time and really gets it to sort of talk about what we're really going to be looking at for the halving, how this halving might be a little different. And then separately, we want to talk about this Bitcoin layer 2 development that we've seen over the past probably 6 months or so. And it's become such a big deal, and it's, you know, getting noticed outside of Bitcoin too, obviously.
Yeah, but, sure.
Well, let's start with the halving, which is something that is really getting a lot of discussion now, Sergio. Yeah. And you've probably been through a few of these now. I'm curious, how is the 2024 halving, if not technically, maybe spiritually, how will it be any different from prior halvings?
I think that I always think that the halvings are priced in. It's not that, you know, I don't expect the halving to produce any big jump in Bitcoin price. I think that from the community perspective, it's a party. It's a moment for celebration that we have achieved such a long road, a long path of becoming, you know, a mainstream cryptocurrency from just an experiment of a single person. And so it's a celebration and has a lot of significance in the Bitcoin community. And I think it should have in all the crypto community. But it's also important from the technical perspective, because each time the price, the emission, the subsidy halves, it means that Bitcoin has more pressure to be sustainable in terms of transaction fees, right? So each time it becomes more and more important for the system to be secure on transaction fees. And I was very interested in finding which are the consequences of this and the ways to mitigate any potential problem that low transaction fees can bring to the security of Bitcoin. And I had this opportunity to solve that problem when I designed Roostock, because Roostock is a blockchain that has no subsidy. It lives on transaction fees. So the whole consensus mechanism of Roostock is designed to be secure even in the complete absence of subsidy. So for me, it was the H halving is very interesting, because I look at how the hash rate responds to it, and I'm trying to guess how close are we to a certain point where we may need to change or improve the protocol to prevent what is called fee snipping, which is basically miners trying to reverse block to steal others' miners' transactions. But we are secure at this point, very, very secure. So for me, it's very interesting to look at what happens with the hash rate.
And what is it exactly you're looking for with the hash rate? Just continual increases, or you want to see the incentive continuing? Is that the main thing?
Well, the theory says that the miners that have a lower, you know, have a higher cost should drop, right? Should leave the network. But this never happened in the past. Like, miners have been very resilient and have continued to increase their hash rate even past halvings. But at some point in time, the less efficient miners will have to drop. And so I'm expecting, I mean, I don't know what will happen, but I expect some portion of hash rate will drop, and new hash rate with better equipment and more efficient machines will take their place.
One thing that might be interesting is that I've thought about in connection with this halving is we've had probably with the approval of these Bitcoin ETFs, there may be more mainstream attention on this halving versus other halvings. Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on that? I mean, is this people talk about how in outside of Bitcoin, it's all about the marketing, but I mean, it's like a free marketing opportunity for Bitcoin, right?
So I don't want to predict Bitcoin price. It's not my area of expertise, but since the ETFs allow anyone to buy Bitcoin, like any news, any important event in Bitcoin history becomes, you know, an important event in terms of trading activity, right? So I expect that this halving will bring more interest from anyone that wants to invest or buy Bitcoin for the future, right?
Yeah.
So it is significant.
Okay, thank you, Sergio. And obviously, there's a lot that's happening with this halving. There's in terms of various project launches too. I you may have followed that Runes from Casey Rodemore is on tap to launch right at the halving. And also, I don't know if you consider Stacks to be a competitor, but their Nakamoto release is going live. And there's a lot that's kind of timed around the halving, just sort of piggybacking on that. But
we also have some very important announcements.
Oh, really? Okay, let's hear it, Sergio.
No, it will be the next time. I don't want to spoil it.
Okay, well, we want to break that news, Sergio, when you're ready to dish. Spill some mate. Well, let's talk about the layer two narrative and rootstock. Maybe just a little bit about rootstock is in a nutshell, is an EVM with Bitcoin merged mining, as right? Dumb it down too much, but maybe just real quick, explain some of those design choices.
Yeah. So I worked along Vitalik in the design of Ethereum, right? I did the first security audits for the Ethereum Foundation, and I was very, very interested in smart contract platforms because I had designed a smart contract platform 1 year before. It was called Qutscoin. So for me, it was fundamental to be able to stack on top of Bitcoin a smart contract platform. For me, it was very important for financial inclusion. So I learned everything from that particular period of time where I tried to help as much as I could for creating the EVM and creating Ethereum. My part is probably minor in the whole thing, but it was my contribution. For instance, the proof of work algorithm that Ethereum used was based on a function that I designed. My goal when I created Rootstock was to bring the EVM on top of Bitcoin. And why I chose the EVM? Because, you know, Bitcoin maxis will never like the EVM because it's a foreign technology, right? But for me, when I saw the potential of the community and the community of developers working around a new virtual machine, I realized that would be where the developers would be, and the tools that they build and the languages that they use, that was where, you know, the fun stuff was going to happen. And if I wanted to bring developers into the Bitcoin ecosystem, the Ethereum developers, then the EVM was the right choice, right? All the EVMs are at the end of the day compatible. Like, you can emulate anyone with any other. Like, the important thing is how easy it is for the existing developers to work on your own on your blockchain, right? So I took the EVM. We did some changes, especially internal changes related to the data structures. Many of the changes that now Ethereum must do, we had the opportunity to redo after we saw how Ethereum design was working, and put that on top of Bitcoin. And it has very interesting like components because it has a bridge, and was the first federated bridge that was created for Bitcoin. It's a Rootstock bridge. It has the merge mining component, which was a completely new component that was redesigned. It's not based on any of the previous merge mine protocols, but it's a new protocol. It has the EVM, but internally, all the data structures were completely rewritten. Rootstock is not based on the Geth code. It's based on completely new code base. So essentially, we had this opportunity. For instance, the data structure, which in Ethereum is it's the try, it's in our case it's a binary try, right? It's in case of Ethereum, it's a very complex Patricia try. It's a different data structure. So we had the opportunity to rebuild it and make it more efficient. So the good thing about Rootstock is that, you know, anyone that knows Solidity can use Solidity tools, but the native currency is Rootstock. It's Bitcoins.
I have a lot of questions actually based on that. You talk about the native currency being Bitcoin. A lot of what you hear from these folks who are launching these layer twos on Bitcoin really does premise on the idea of value being locked into the Bitcoin ecosystem, and at a scale that, you know, isn't the case for Ethereum or other ecosystems, and that being the driving factor. It kind of starts and ends there when you ask them why they're doing it on Bitcoin. It's because all the money's there. I wonder if that's something that you've noticed, and whether that's kind of a sentiment that you share or you feel is kind of, you know, misrepresented or misappropriated by folks building on the ecosystem.
Yeah. So personally, my goal when I designed Roostock was that it could be used for financial inclusion. Financial inclusion is a very interesting topic because it requires to have stable coins. Like, people are not going to invest or trade or make payments in Bitcoin at the beginning. People who are unbanked or financially excluded, they need to be able to use stable coins at the beginning. So for me, Roostock was the way to bring Bitcoin collateralized stablecoins, decentralized Bitcoin collateralized stablecoins into this ecosystem so that people could use it for financial inclusion to move dollar denominated coins and then move into Bitcoin. So for me, the use case is financial inclusion, and I measure the success of Roostock in terms of how many people are actually active users, transacting, sending money abroad, paying, receiving payment from abroad, savings. That's the metrics. But of course, the ecosystem uses TVL, I don't know, tokens, all other metrics that essentially they reflect the hype and reflect, you know, how much investors' money is coming into the blockchains. And I don't disregard that. I think that's also important. It's not exactly what I look into a blockchain. What I look is active users and technology.
If I can reframe my question, that was all interesting, so I didn't want to interrupt you, but I think I phrased that wrong, where my question is more around, when people talk about building on Bitcoin, it's less around the technology of the Bitcoin blockchain, and it seems more around the, you know, value of the Bitcoin blockchain. So I'm not talking about like what yours or anybody else's TVL is. It's more around Bitcoin's TVL itself and the fact that that's why people are building on it. Is there anything fundamental to Bitcoin's technology that you think lends itself really well to being a smart contract platform relative to other ecosystems that were built that way, kind of from the ground up?
Bitcoin itself is not a good smart contract platform because the choices that Satoshi made are very, very conservative. There was, you know, the block size wars, which basically solidified a certain path forwards, which means that Bitcoin is becoming more and more of a store of value and less of a payment network, which is okay to me if we can build layers on top of Bitcoin. Maybe I don't know if I respond to your question, but that the people who are on Bitcoin are not specifically for the smart contracts, but more and more, and I see people around me, there are people who want to save for a long time Bitcoins and they want to get collateralized loans on those Bitcoins. And I see this a lot. So they move their Bitcoins into a layer two because centralized lending platforms have shown to be completely a disaster. So they are moving into these platforms to get stable coins, loans, so they are able to periodically spend those stable coins instead of spending their Bitcoin. And, you know, if 1% of the people's Bitcoins moved into layer twos, then we will have a huge market for this.
Now, is there any concern?
Obviously, it's up to see, you know.
You've historically, you know, been pretty deep in the Bitcoin ecosystem, but you're also unique in that it seems like you've been very exposed and involved in the Ethereum side as well. And obviously, those are two distinct cultures where Ethereum kind of came up with all of these concepts that you're talking about in mind around smart contracts. And Bitcoin was the opposite, like you just said.
I may interrupt you. It's not the opposite. Those concepts were discussed in Bitcoin in 2011 and 2012. Is that the people in Bitcoin decided not to pursue them? It's not they weren't discussed. They were discussed a lot.
But so maybe that's the question. So has that changed? And who's driving the change? Is it people coming from the Ethereum smart contract end? Or is it Bitcoiners who are kind of just changing their mindset?
There's a mixture. There's people coming from Ethereum that still are Bitcoiners and they want to see some of these advances move to Bitcoin.
Many of the Bitcoiners, I consider myself a Bitcoin monetary maximalist, but I'm not a technology, how we call it, maxi in the terms of technology. I don't think that Bitcoin technology is perfect and should never be changed and should be ossified, right? I think it needs to change in order to support upper layers, for instance, rollups, for instance, better bridges with layer two, with sidechain, etc. So there is a lot of Bitcoiners which do not identify themselves with strictly the super maxis, but they just want to build on top of Bitcoin. And over time, I think this is the bigger group. Sometimes they are attacked. Sometimes there's very heated discussions on Bitcoin conferences, on Twitter, but it's part of the game. You have to understand that if you engage with the Bitcoin community, you have to be ready to be criticized. And it happened to me. It's very scary at first, but then you realize it's part of the game. But when having been into Ethereum community, I think that it's much more open. It's much more welcoming, and the developers, the number of open source tools that are being created every day, it's fantastic, and I love that. And that's why I want to bring that culture into Roostock and Bitcoin layers 2 in general, because I'm a supporter of Bitcoin layers 2, the whole ecosystem.
Just to say, it's good for my ego to hear, Sergio, that you also are terrified of crypto Twitter. That's going to make me feel much better for the next few months. But anyway, we're going to take a quick break here. We'll be right back with Sergio Damian Lerner.
Thanks.
Have a blockchain project idea and need funding to make it happen? Look no further. The Stellar Community Fund is here to help bring your project to life on the Stellar Network. This year alone, over $10 million in XLM awards have been allocated across more than 100 innovative projects. And your idea could be next. Approved project submissions can receive up to $100,000 in XLM per project. So head over to communityfund.stellar.org to get started.
Calling all developers. Score a Consensus 2024 Developer Pass for just $109, but act fast. Only a limited number of these passes are available. You may have heard that Consensus ain't for devs, but here's why you're wrong. Consensus is the only place you can fully immerse yourself in a multi-chain environment and learn directly from 20-plus chains, including Arbitrum, Chainlink, Solana, and more. Enjoy 3 days of intensive learning with technical talks, 40-plus expert speakers, and 20-plus in-depth workshops, including dedicated half-days for Ethereum and Bitcoin, and 3 full days of programming on our Protocol Village stage. Consensus 2024 is happening May 29th through 31st in Austin, Texas. Don't miss your chance to network at curated developer meetups, find new career opportunities, and explore hundreds of side events and hacker houses around town. Grab your $109 developer pass today, but remember, this exclusive offer is limited. Visit consensus.coindesk.com now to secure your developer pass before they're gone. Explore the epicenter of blockchain innovation at Consensus 2024. And we're back with Sergio Damian Lerner of Roostock. And let's see, Sergio, I'm curious, you know, you have been toiling away working on Roostock for a while, and the Bitcoin layer 2 narrative, it wasn't getting a lot of traction, right? And now all of a sudden it's everybody's talking about it. I'm just curious for your thoughts on that real quick.
Yeah, so several things happen. I think that I'm not particularly interested in NFTs, not particularly interested in runs or all these meme things.
But what I am interested in is building on top of Bitcoin and giving the freedom to developers. So once you create a platform, you don't censor anyone. You just let anyone use the platform as they wish. And then the creative, the imagination and the creative of developers bring, you know, all the rest. And that's key for any kind of software platform. So what I loved about, you know, these new developments is the idea that people are, interested in building stuff on top of Bitcoin. My personal interest is nothing related to that. It's financial inclusion. But I think that this is a benefit for all because, you know, the interest, the hype, the developers are coming back into Bitcoin. So that's why even if I'm not... I have my, you know, my dividing line between what is a sidechain and what is not, what is a real Bitcoin aligned project and what is not. And I have my personal opinion. I welcome every layer two to experiment, to do the best, to be Bitcoin aligned. And we will see. We will see what happens. But I think that the disrupting factor after this BRC20 and NFTs on Bitcoin, the disrupting factor was Robin Linus's discovery of BitVM. That changed everything. Because now the community has a tool to build a better bridge, a more decentralized bridge. And so a problem that was thought to be, you know, impossible, now it has a solution. It's not a very efficient solution. And I must tell you that a group of researchers and me, we are optimizing BitVM. We will soon publish some very, very interesting new things about how to optimize BitVM and make it better. But still, you know, the fact that some new discovery turned something that was considered impractical into something completely realistic and practical to build bridges changed completely the landscape. So this is the reason new L2s have really popped up in the last month or years.
And are you working with Robin Linus on that, or is he or is that separate?
Well, I'm collaborating with him, exchanging ideas. Obviously, I'm following what he's doing, but we have with our group, we have turned a different path. We have decided that to choose a different design. Robin is coding his own implementation, which he chose certain design decisions, and we have chosen several different design decisions we think are much more efficient in the long term. So that's what we are concentrated. We are focused on a different implementation, open source, completely neutral for any sidechain or any L2 to use to build better bridges.
I want to ask real quick, you know, we were previously just talking a little bit about the comparisons, especially since you were in the middle between Ethereum and Bitcoin. And just to set things up, I report on Ethereum on the team. So I wanted to sort of get that perspective from you. And I know you mentioned that you want to, you know, when it comes to building on Bitcoin, you want to bring that cultural community of like open sourceness collaboration to Bitcoin. I'm wondering too, as well, you know, Ethereum has had a lot of experience now with building all sorts of different things. What's the opposite of that? Like, maybe what are the faux pas you're sort of like have watched what's happened in the Ethereum space and like, okay, let's not do that on Bitcoin.
There are several problems, I would say. One is the deep complexity of the Ethereum protocol after a proof of stake. Like in this point in time, there are several groups working in different parts of the stack, and nobody knows completely how it works. Like nobody has a deep knowledge of every single piece. And that's problematic in terms of computer security. Complex systems tend to present vulnerabilities. I myself have reported two or even three vulnerabilities to the Ethereum bug bounty because of the complexities. So that I see that this is a problem. This and centralization problem is another problem. Like moving to proof of stake was obviously something that the community had agreed to do, but still it's an experiment. It's a huge experiment to see how you can actually sustain the network without much centralization. Obviously, I hope this experiment results in a best possible outcome, but it's still an ongoing experiment. The other problem I see is that there was a decision made at a certain point not to scale the base layer with sharding and all different techniques, but to let these layer twos, these rollups, to develop on Ethereum, which I think that from the point of view of entrepreneurship and VCs, it's excellent. Like, you let anyone experiment the same way that Ethereum was an experiment. Now, these new rollups are an experiment, so you bring more developers and everything. But now you have a problem, right? The ecosystem is too fragmented. Each one of these rollups may have their own tokens, so there is no direct alignment with Ethereum. So, you know, the two sides of the same coin, right? You have a lot of excitement and hype, but at the same time, you have fragmentation of liquidity, fragmentation. There's no share sequencer. There's some problems. So
The fragmentation, yeah. You're sort of attributing to the move to proof of stake, or become like an all-encompassing ecosystem, like.
Because of the different layers, like on top of Ethereum, which is, again, it's great because it's growing. It means it's growing. But at the same time, if each one of these new rollups brings a coin, a token, and then transaction fees move to these rollups, and then, you know, there might be a lack of use on the base layer, and we will see. Maybe the difference at this point between Ethereum and Bitcoin and is the level of experimentation you can do, right? Mm-hmm. In Bitcoin, it's limited because it's moving towards a store of value, and that's the narrative, and you have to accept that. And whatever is built is probably will be built on top of Bitcoin in layers. It's not going to be embedded into Bitcoin protocol, and mm-hmm. that's the rules. While in Ethereum, everything can change. You know, it's part of the game. You know, it's part of the experiment,
mm-hmm.
And I love that. But I wouldn't choose Ethereum as a store of value, mm-hmm. personally.
It's really interesting, you know, that you bring up that proof of stake is still like in an experiment phase, because I feel like, you know, in blockchain, we're now almost 2 years to a year and a half out of the merge, right? And it sort of feels like it's dog years where we're like, I don't know, we've been there, done that, it works. We've had all sorts of different upgrades on the Ethereum side. And then you also, you know, I know that you have came up with the algorithm for mining on Ethereum. I kind of want to go back in time a little bit, because I remember specifically like when there was this transition from proof of work to proof of stake, there were a lot of Bitcoiners that were like, this is not going to happen. Like, we've had all these years mm-hmm. of research, you know, proof of work works. I want to sort of hear, you know, we are now a year and a half into this, and I know you're like, this is still an experiment, but it's working for the most part, I would say. So take me back sort of to that moment, like what camp were you in on that time? And also I kind of want to hear about what happened to the miners. Like, you know, I think you were sort of at this core, the core of bringing proof of work to life, furthering it on Ethereum. And now it's in a different place. So yeah, what happened to all these people?
Well, first, about the history of the movement from proof of work of proof of stake, obviously, maybe some Ethereum core developer knows much more than me about this, but I was following the project and I saw that the proof of stake was being delayed and delayed and delayed. And the reason is because it's complex. The proof of work system is quite simple. Like, you can explain it to a toddler and he would probably understand. And the proof of stake is much more complex because you have to protect from short range attacks and long range attacks. And it's difficult to make a light client. So there's a specific protocol for light clients. And then there is a lot of problems which were pretty solved, right? They were pretty well solved, but took a lot of time. And so many people were not convinced when that would happen. And it was so, but finally it happened. But it didn't happen without problems. Like, there was two or three papers after the move to proof of stake that actually proved that Ethereum proof of stake algorithms has some flaws and were solved because of those papers. Like, it was not, you know, rose colors, right? It did have promise. Hopefully, nobody exploited that promise. That's a good thing. But it is still a complex protocol. And if you take a look at how, you know, an Ethereum node is organized with a consensus client and then execution part, it's pretty complex.
But you didn't doubt, like you sort of understood that this is happening, even though like it was years and years of research.
It was reading in the white, when something is reading in white paper, it's what the community agrees to do. So there was no choice to go back to proof of work or to avoid the proof of stake. That was part of the path. People bought into Ethereum because they believed in proof of stake, and so that had to happen. Obviously, it happened a little bit late on the project, but it happened, and I'm glad that the project accomplished one of the main objectives. Right, I find certain problems in proof of stake, which is basically the nothing at stake problem, the problem of about old keys and all. But you know, in practice, most of the theoretical attacks that you can think of in practice never happen. So maybe that attack never really materialized.
Sergio, just to, I think we're getting close to the end here, but just wanted to ask a question about the culture of upgrades on Bitcoin. There's a whole debate going on now about how to get these BIPs through and how hard it is to just get, even get a number for your Bitcoin improvement proposal. And then you have Ethereum, where there still are upgrades, relatively major upgrades, at least once a year, with kind of a big package of stuff. And there's a there's ongoing discussions about that. Whereas Bitcoin, it seems like decentralization equals kind of lack of any formal organization at all. And you mentioned the BitVM, and that's been a breakthrough, right? Is because you don't need any changes to the code of Bitcoin, right?
And yes.
And then Rootstock is this side chain. Right. But the BitVM it's going to allow these, layer twos on top of Bitcoin to be more like rollups in Ethereum. Right. Is that correct? Would you agree with that characterization?
BitVM is a optimistic or distributable computing paradigm. So it's not meant to replace, to bring smart contracts right into Bitcoin, in a sense like, those contracts are not as responsive and as fast as, Rootstock smart contract or Ethereum smart contract, where you have, 10 seconds, 30 seconds interaction with the blockchain. So these contracts in Bitcoin require a lot of time for potential dispute resolution, right? Maybe month of dispute resolution. So essentially, the main application of BitVM is to build bridges or some other sort of layer two. It's not meant to, create a smart wallet on top of Bitcoin. That's not the idea. The idea is to bring bridges and other components that connect to layer twos into Bitcoin. So you can think about that as a part of a operating system. And then once you create a sidechain or an L2, then that's where, the common standard trading or DEX or whatever smart contracts really live.
With this innovation, do you see Rootstock changing over from, the current structure of side chain with this two-way peg with the Bitcoin and the merge mining? Is this a better structure?
Yeah, I see two major events happening in the future. Okay. One is we are working to present to the Rootstock community a better bridge based on BitVM. That's a fact. We are working towards that, and we will soon have news, papers, announcements. And obviously, it's up to the community to decide, but we think that we can build a system that is much more decentralized and even more secure. And we have invested, the community has invested several years in securing the Rootstock bridge. So for us, it's very, it's very moving to reinvest and innovate on top of our own protocol to bring this to Rootstock. What I see really happening in Bitcoin is that once we have these new bridges, the chance that a new opcode is added to Bitcoin to replace all the complexities of BitVM is not simple. It's complex. It will be much higher because if you can do it in a complex way, there is no reason why not to introduce some changes to do it in a simpler way, because you can do it anyway. So why would you oppose to have, you know, an opcode that does multiplication? Bitcoin doesn't have currently an opcode that does multiplication, and all the BitVM stuff invests a lot of opcodes to build multiplication by successive additions. Why wouldn't put a multiplication opcode on top of Bitcoin if, you know, you are doing it anyway? Or why won't you introduce the cat, the opcat opcode, if you can simulate that with, you know, Blake 3 hash function or whatever? So once we have these bridges with BitVM, I think that the mentality of the most Bitcoin will have to change. Okay? Obviously, it's my opinion, maybe never changed, but I think that the situation is completely different. Once you can do something anyway, and then you just propose to do it more efficiently.
Yeah, fascinating. Well, we're going to wrap it there, Sergio. Wow, what an incredible episode this has been. Thank you so much.
Thanks
for joining us. Really fascinating, and you're right in the thick of it. So we'll be watching Rootstock, and thank you for sharing the news with us that you discussed. That is a wrap for this week's episode of the Protocol Podcast. Thank you for listening, and thank you to our producer, Michelle Musso, and our booker, Mel Montañez. And if you have any questions about any stories or comments, please reach out to us at podcasts@coindesk.com, subject line, The Protocol. You can listen to us weekly on CoinDesk Podcast Network or wherever you get your podcasts. Also, please subscribe to our weekly newsletter, The Protocol, on CoinDesk.com. See you next week.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.